The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the archives of the New Yorker magazine, specifically the May 20th, 1996 edition. A critic at large section, Dr. Spock's Baby, 50 Years in the Life of a Book and the American Family by Anne Hulbert. Dr. Benjamin Spock, who is 93, has been the pediatrician on perpetual house call for millions of American families over the past half century. His Baby and Child Care was published in May of 1946, has been revised 5 times, and has sold more than 43 million copies. Today, Dr. Spock's own house is a 20-foot cream-colored Winnebago named the Tortoise, parked in the yard of friends in Miami, where Spock and his second wife, Mary Morgan, spend half the year. Until 1992, they lived on the Carapace, a 35-foot sailboat, but they sold it when Spock's footing became less sure on deck and because they wanted to be in closer touch with his doctors. Spock, who has worn a pacemaker since he had a heart attack 9 years ago, and who suffered a brief stroke-like episode 6 years ago, has also taken his health into his own hands. Or rather, Mary Morgan, who is 52, has taken it into hers. Every day, she devotes many hours to preparing macrobiotic meals for the two of them in their tiny kitchen. One evening recently, the doctor and Morgan entertained a female acupuncturist named Sachi at a restaurant in Coconut Grove. Dr. Spock had a cold, and Sachi had spent that afternoon pounding his back, applying needles, and practicing yoga with him. During dinner, Dr. Spock, the friendly New Englander, left the New Age talk mostly to the women and hungrily turned to the meal that Morgan had ordered specifically for him. His wife extolled the curative powers of the arugula, the sea vegetable, and the kale. Sachi serenely said that she could see all the food sparkling with energy and that she had prayed to her swordfish before biting into him. "I could just tell somehow it was a he," she commented, and Morgan agreed, saying, "I saw him in the kitchen and he had a very masculine eye." Dr. Spock, teasing in a slightly tense-jawed way, remarked that the two of them could be taken for nuts and kept on eating. Dr. Spock's wry equanimity hardly seems a revolutionary trait, but 50 years ago it made him the spokesman for and the symbol of a radical departure from dogmatic rigidity in American attitudes toward child-rearing. Scientific-minded pediatricians in the first half of what progressives anointed the century of the child issued patronizing directions to mothers about their children's physical care, especially their feeding. The doctors insisted above all on regularity for healthy intestines and for good character. "Save the baby from summer complaint, severe diarrhea," they instructed, "and make him a solid citizen fit for an industrial society." By the 1920s, bullying behaviorists had taken over. John B. Watson, whose psychological care of infant and child reigned throughout the 30s, informed parents that their children were theirs to shape and ridiculed mothers as emotionally overwrought cuddlers and clingers rather than cool trainers with the capacity to treat children as though they were young adults. Love, Watson was convinced, bred unwholesome dependence. With rising disgust, he monitored a cozy family car ride during which one poor small passenger was kissed 32 times, 4 by his mother, 8 by the nurse, and 20 times by the grandmother. Dr. Spock offered children and parents a welcome end to scolding and strictures. "Trust yourself. You know more than you think you do," he told parents in the now famous opening paragraphs of his book. "Don't take too seriously all that the neighbors say. Don't be overawed by what the experts say. Don't be afraid to trust your own common sense. Trust your children," he went on to urge young middle-class mothers and fathers, "and show them plenty of affection." The response was an outpouring of trust in him as a warmly non-authoritarian authority for an age of prosperity. I feel as if you were talking chess to me, one of his early followers wrote to him. You make me feel as if you thought I was a sensible person. His book sold 750,000 copies in its first year, without advertising. The American Journal of Public Health judged baby and child care to typify the present-day departure from rigidity in schedules and training, and praised it for its moderation. Quote, Dr. Spock has succeeded to an amazing degree in striking a middle ground in his advice. End quote. His secret, a columnist explained in the Times, was that he knew how to offer suggestions on dealing with children as people, yet didn't cease to treat parents as people, too. In the more flexible and egalitarian family that Dr. Spock described, parents were not held up to an impossible standard. The Times writer appreciatively cited Dr. Spock's tips for the mother whose child has collapsed in a raging heap. You can't dodge all temper tantrums. A mother would be unnatural if she had that much patience and tact, Spock wrote, and proposed that when the meltdown happens on a busy sidewalk, the parent simply pick him up, with a grin if you can force it, and tug him off to a quiet spot where you can both cool off in private. Dr. Spock spoke like a down-to-earth amateur who favored the human touch whenever it was possible over mechanistic technique. Don't ask, do you want to eat lunch, and get into an argument, he advised, but lead or carry the child to the table, still chatting with him about the thing that was on his mind before. He conceded that you might get the idea that I am advising you to swoop down on him and give him the bum's rush. But he assumed that his readers would manage more smoothly. It helps to be tactful, he summed up tactfully. The arrival of a new sibling, a frequent event in the post-war years, called for agile maneuvering on the home front. Lift and don't strike. When a mother sees her child advancing on the baby with a grim look on his face and a weapon in his hand, she must jump and grab him, Dr. Spock wrote. But then she can turn the grab into a hug and reassure him of her love. Young mothers and fathers, often many miles from their own parents in a mobile era, had found an expert they could feel comfortably attached to. I've got a copy in the living room, a copy in the bedroom, a copy in the kitchen, a copy in the bathroom, one of his many correspondents told him. It was flattering, Dr. Spock says, to be held in such awe. Except that, to his mind, it was also worrisome. What had happened to the confident, independent parents he'd hoped to inspire? The success of Dr. Spock's book has been paradoxical as well as spectacular. The doctor who quietly rebelled against the imperious and impersonal medical experts of the first half of the century very quickly emerged as America's paramount child-rearing authority, and his gospel of cheerful moderation and family harmony went forth into immoderate, dissonant times. Like his readers, Dr. Spock has had to struggle to readjust a vision of family ease in the face of mounting evidence of family strain and collapse. In fact, he himself was not, as husband and father, the gentle authority figures his readers revered, and his home was far from the relaxed haven his book evoked. Dr. Spock didn't let the difficulties daunt him, but he hasn't tried to hide them either. Within the Anodyne Self-Help Guide to Parental Self-Confidence, there is an anxious book about parental insecurity. No book has all the answers, Dr. Spock warned his readers at the start. But over the years, he has kept trying to respond to incessant questions about how to do it right. The 6 editions of Baby and Child Care are a record of a half century of quintessentially American optimism and panic about the fate of the family. Dr. Spock says he views his indomitable mother, Mildred Stoughton Spock, as the crucial influence on his personal and professional life. His father, Benjamin Ives Spock, who was a lawyer for the New Haven Railroad, was very quiet, like some men are, especially in America. The doctor, who was the eldest of 6 children, salutes him as grave but just, but remembers him most for his remoteness. Mrs. Spock was fierce, a Tartar, her daughter Marjorie says. Dr. Spock himself, who can still get surprisingly worked up about his mother, describes her as a very moralistic, excessively controlling, and puritanical on the subject of sex. She suspected naughtiness everywhere and subjected her cowed sons and daughters to regular interrogations about their deeds, thoughts, and friends. The mildest lapse from purity registered on their guilty faces, Dr. Spock recalls with a vestigial cringe. And in what her son later saw as a style typically adopted by conscientious parents early in the century, Mrs. Spock negotiated her way among a growing array of child-rearing experts while maintaining her unwavering authoritarianism. She was a zealous adherent of Dr. Luther Emmett Holt's prescriptive Care and Feeding of Children, published in 1894, the most popular child-rearing book of its time. For Holt, diet was the key to health, which was the key to wholesome happiness, and he dictated a strict regimen. Mrs. Spock deemed bananas to be dangerous, so Ben was appalled when one of his friends offered them around as a treat, and was mortified to be the only child who had to refuse one. At the age of 9, Ben, who enjoyed being a regular pupil going to a regular school, was pulled out to spend 2 years in an open-air classroom, organized by local parents and presided over by an assistant professor of philosophy at Yale and his energetic wife. Ben huddled outdoors in a thick felt bag while he studied and was ridiculed as one of the, quote, hot air kids, end quote, by tougher local boys. In 1919, when he was 16, Ben was thrilled to be sent to Andover, above all because it put distance between him and home. By then, the worried little boy seen in childhood photographs had shot up into a skeletally thin teenager, desperate to escape a sense of himself as a mother's boy. He longed to be a regular guy, and when he went on to Yale, where his father had gone before him, he got the perfect chance. He rode on the victorious Yale crew in the 1924 Olympics. He entered the Yale Medical School the following year, already sure of what he wanted to be, a pediatrician. Dr. Spock dedicated his career to a psychological concern with emotions, both children's and parents, which had been notably lacking in his own home. In the stern family in which I grew up, there was no allowance made for psychological or human explanation of naughty or unwise behavior. Every issue was somehow a matter of morality or health, Dr. Spock wrote. And by the 30s and the ascending of behaviorist psychology, every issue had become a matter of conditioned reflexes. Yet, Dr. Spock resists describing his career either as a case of rebellion against his mother or as one of professional trailblazing. Rather, like the medical institutions, and like many American parents around him, he was cautiously, under-assertively, he often says, feeling his way toward alternatives to the old-fashioned techniques. In 1927, he transferred to the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, where he was first in his class. He followed up with 2 internships, spending 2 years at Columbia's Presbyterian Hospital and then a year at Cornell's Nursery and Child Hospital. But he found himself stymied in his clinical work by parents' everyday questions about their children's behavior. Dr. Milton J. E. Sin, a contemporary of Spock's, in 1948, Sin succeeded Dr. Arnold Gazelle as director of the Child Study Center at Yale, has described widespread discontentment in doctors' offices during the 30s and 40s. Pediatricians were, quote, confounded and annoyed by the large number of distraught, angry and frazzled mothers in their practices who were balking at the rigid feeding methods of the day and the dispassionate behaviorist training style, but weren't sure what they should do instead, end quote. Mary McCarthy, in her novel The Group, caricatured the mood of maternal anxiety in a conversation between two of her Vassar 1933 graduates, Chris Crockett and Noreen Schmidtlap, who meet on a bench in Central Park with their babies in the late 30s. The nervously fastidious Pris is married to a pediatrician of the, quote, 610-2, end quote, school of scheduled feeding, who trained her never to pick up their son between feedings except to change his diaper or give him a drink of water, and she is trying to think of herself as a mother who, quote, keeps up with the latest developments, end quote, from the behaviorist and child development lab. But she doesn't really feel like one, not least because her toddler still won't perform on the toity seat. Noreen, who takes a blithely permissive attitude, piques her anxiety, and Pris uneasily eyes her friend's three-month-old, Ichabod, sunning naked in his carriage and blissfully sucking on a pacifier. Noreen, who feeds him on demand, confidently predicts that he'll give up his anal pleasures under peer pressure at nursery school. Dr. Spock, along with Dr. Sen and a few others, was improvising a course between McCarthy's comic extremes. Spock started with a residency at Payne Whitney in 1932, and then, after launching his pediatric practice, spent five more years in training at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute during the evenings. The doctor, who has described himself as a person who's learned by sort of latching on to people and acquiring secondhand whatever I'm able to comprehend, also began working with members of the progressive education movement. All along, he was struggling during the Depression to support a family. He and his first wife, Jane Chaney, a Connecticut bluebud whom he had courted while she was at Bryn Mawr and he was at Yale, had a son in 1933. Dr. Spock's quirky psychiatric reputation didn't initially attract hordes of patients, but it did catch the attention of publishers. In 1938, an astute Doubleday editor, eager to commission a primer by a psychologically inclined pediatrician, approached Dr. Spock. The doctor turned him down, claiming too little experience. He was trying to apply Freudian ideas of underlying drives rather than the usual notion of mere bad habits, as he experimented with practical advice about thumb-sucking, weaning, toilet training, separation anxiety. The problems then, as always, on mothers' minds. But he felt he needed to learn more from those mothers about what worked and what didn't. 5 years later, when Donald Geddes of Pocket Books asked him to write a manual, Dr. Spock was ready. But in 1944, he joined the Navy as a doctor, and a project that was supposed to take 6 months stretched to 3 years as he carted a growing manuscript from post to post. He was helped by Jane, who, at home in New York, did research, checked facts, and took down his many revisions as she cared for their new son, who was born in 1944. The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care appeared 2 years later with the baby boom. Rarely has the delay of a book been so well timed. All parents do their best job when they have a natural, easy confidence in themselves, Dr. Spock assured his readers, not when they're trying to do everything letter perfect out of a feeling of worry. Anyway, he pointed out, there is no such thing as letter perfect in the upbringing of a child. Our ideas about how to treat a child have changed a lot in the past and will certainly change in the future, he wrote. This book only tries to give you sensible present-day ideas of the care of a child, taking into account his physical and emotional needs. It's not infallible. Following intuition and instincts, he emphasized, is almost always better than obeying instructions. With its goal of parental peace of mind rather than perfection, Dr. Spock's book, which Dwight MacDonald singled out for praise in his essay How-Toism, published in The New Yorker in 1954, joined a growing American self-help subgenre. In MacDonald's taxonomy, It was not a success manual for ambitious strivers, but an inspirational book for earnest muddlers who were eager for reassuring, soothing messages. As MacDonald wrote, the self-help writer has two powerful drugs in his pharmacopoeia, psychology and religion. Dr. Spock's was psychology, and in his first edition, he applied it to children in a way that no one before him had done, along with up-to-date medical advice and homespun practical know-how about children's physical care, down to the best way to get a shirt on and off over an infant's head. Dr. Spock offered his readers an explanation of children's emotional development, a dose of what MacDonald called know why. The Freudian concepts he employed were, in the words of one admirer, camouflaged in such palatable form that they slide like soda pop down the most distrustful gullet. Dr. Spock presented parents with children who were eager to please, crediting them with a deep desire to grow up to be like the parents they admire and love. In lucid, conversational prose, Dr. Spock described a natural, easy path of growth. Children will develop regular habits without being forced into regularity. Infants want to eat what they need to eat and will settle into a feeding rhythm if they're given the chance. Leave bowel training almost entirely up to your baby, for a child will completely train himself sooner or later if no struggle has taken place, Spock wrote. Sexual impulses lead to curious exploration and emulation, not to dark frustrations, and the Oedipal phase, between 3 and 6, is a nice age. Children's anatomical fears evoked sweet anecdotes. I heard of a little girl who complained to her mother, "But she's so fancy and I'm so plain," he wrote in his book. And in a column he noted, "My favorite example is the little girl who gazed thoughtfully at her plate and asked, 'Is a Frankfurter a boy or a girl?'" An older child doesn't need to be pushed to take his place as a responsible citizen of the outside world. It's a pleasant privilege. To be sure, the steady progress that Dr. Spock described can go awry with the wrong handling. Toddlers can become biters, eager feeders can turn balky, and older children can withdraw. But if the cause and the cure are not easy to see, a children's psychiatrist will be able to help, Dr. Spock wrote. And he made that sound easy and natural, too. Yet, when the doctor took his inspirational show on the road in the late 1940s, he was unsettled to discover very little parental peace of mind. As an itinerant professor at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota from 1947 to 1951, at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School from 1951 to 1955, and finally at the Western Reserve Medical School in Cleveland, 1955 to 1967, he focused attention on family dynamics and parental involvement in a pediatric field that often seemed anti-parent. You know, there are elaborate technical and obscure aspects of emotional development which it would be good to know if you've been able to secure the training, he liked to tell his students. But 9/10 of what you do psychologically is just be nice to your parents. When Dr. Spock talked to non-academic crowds, as he was constantly invited to do, parents barraged him with pleas for reassurance. "It's a revelation to see audience reaction to him," a friend of his told a journalist in 1960. "The women strain toward him. They're happy. They seem to be saying, 'Tell me more. Reassure me that it won't be awful if I get angry with my child.' It is almost a form of group therapy." On a television show that Dr. Spock hosted for several years in the 1950s, he discovered that something firmer than his comforting presence was in demand. He did his best to fade into the background and let the mother speak up, but what a large part of the audience wanted was an authoritative preachment, he recalled. So it was canceled. Dr. Spock's first edition had tried to discourage the desire for more authoritative guidance. But a flood of new concepts about child development had crested very quickly. Too quickly, he suggested in his second edition, which came out in 1957. Summarizing the rapid shift away from the old strictness, he noted that it's not possible for a civilization like ours to go through such a change of philosophy. It really amounts to a revolution, without raising doubts in many parents' minds and without getting some parents thoroughly mixed up. Flexibility could be more unnerving than cut-and-dried rules, and Freudian psychology could be just as intimidating as behaviorist psychology. Parents who had worried about molding their children now had to worry about repressing them. Dr. Spock feared that parents were being intimidated on two fronts, by experts and by their own children. And he was concerned that his book had unwittingly played into their insecurity. So, a child-centered first edition became a parent-focused second edition. Dr. Spock cited a letter from a mother in Texas in the mid-1950s as the decisive jolt. She praised him for his sympathy, but confided that she was not at all reassured by his glowing portrait of childhood. "Don't you realize," she asked, "that when you always emphasize that a child basically wants to behave well and will behave well if he's handled wisely, you make the parent feel responsible for everything that goes wrong? Perhaps some people wouldn't get that feeling, but I do, and it is more burdensome and discouraging and oppressive than I can ever express. Can't you see that a parent is a human being too?" Dr. Spock had never meant to let children overawe their elders. He added a section called Parents Are Human to the 1957 revision, reassuring his readers that ambivalent feelings are natural and that resentful self-sacrifice is bad both for parents and for children and creates a vicious cycle of guilt. He now told parents to be firm more often. This wasn't an about-face. He was simply changing emphases, spelling out what he had earlier felt went without saying or had merely mentioned in passing. He had initially written, "Don't be afraid to love him and respond to his needs." He now amended that passage to, "Don't be afraid to love him and enjoy him. Don't be afraid to respond to other desires of his as long as they seem sensible to you, and as long as you don't become a slave to him." Now he blamed himself and other psychiatrists, psychologists, and pediatricians for making parents too hesitant about toilet training. "Remember that the goal is cooperation," he said, "but start encouraging it in the second year." Children, however well-intentioned, were inexperienced and impulsive and quick to tyrannize a submissive adult, but they would be grateful for more parental gumption. Dr. Spock still promised affable peace, not struggle. As he had noted in the first edition, a child needs to feel that his mother and father, however agreeable, have their own rights, know how to be firm, won't let him be unreasonable or rude. He likes them better that way. Now, Dr. Spock urged parents to heed their own parents' strongly rooted ways. Tradition, not just instinct or intuition, much less an expert's tips, was the best cure for hesitancy, which Dr. Spock elsewhere identified as the commonest problem in child-rearing in America today. Coming from the mid-century progressive critic of old-style methods, this was a startling retrenchment. But Dr. Spock made the shift seem an effortless matter, of course. "This is nothing to be ashamed of," he said. "This is the way nature expects human beings to learn child care from their own childhood." As a husband and a father, especially during the 50s, Dr. Spock practiced the traditionalism he had begun to preach in his second edition, but he didn't manage it with the ease that his book advertised to parents. Dr. Spock had inherited an unexpected amount of his mother's strictness. His own family life, as profiles of the Spocks intermittently pointed out, was not the permissive haven that fans tended to expect. Dr. Spock was a firm father. What the accounts missed was that he could sometimes be an oppressively fierce one. He turns out to have been, in the eyes of his first wife and his sons, a surprisingly moralistic authority figure, as the Spocks enacted their version of the classic 50s drama of marital and generational strain behind a happy domestic facade. The family moved frequently, and Jane found the dislocations hard. She also resented her husband's growing fame, feeling that her work on baby and child care entitled her to a greater share of the renown. In the early 50s, her sons say she began to suffer from manic depressive cycles, was hospitalized for a time after a severe episode, and later became dependent on medication and alcohol. Dr. Spock is the first to admit that within his own family he has often been short on the calm sympathy he so readily dispensed to his patients, friends, colleagues, and devoted readers. Ben seems like this outgoing, loving, easygoing person, but really he isn't. He's a stern person, Jane Shaney Spock revealed in an interview with The Times shortly before their divorce became final in 1976. Their two sons, too, describe an extremely exacting figure, and Dr. Spock has acknowledged that his boys, though they called him Ben, were too afraid of me. His younger son, John, says that he feels less judgmental about the way my father did it, now that he is a father himself. Yet, he recalls that as a seemingly composed little boy, greatly disturbed by family troubles, he experienced a strange, wrenching, painful kind of childhood at times. He remembers sobbing uncontrollably after striking out in a baseball game at recess one day when he was in the third grade, during what was a particularly bad year for his mother. No teacher presumed to probe for a problem. It was unthinkable that Dr. Spock's son wasn't getting the help he needed at home. In the memories that still preoccupy him, his father looms as an angry figure, prone to leave him, as a boy, feeling judged, criticized, scared, beaten down. But that father also presides as a daunting model to admire, who set high standards of selfless striving. Dr. Spock says much the same thing of his mother, whom he resented for her oppressive strictures, but credits as the inspiration behind his political activism beginning in the 1960s. Mildred Spock was a galvanizing example of conscientious nonconformism. She gave us deep conviction about our obligation to serve, to put idealism above materialism, to think independently, to be courageous about our beliefs, Dr. Spock says, embracing the high-mindedness that had embarrassed him as a boy. A grandfatherly presence in a three-piece suit on the barricades with long-haired youth as the Vietnam War escalated, Dr. Spock didn't mind risking accusations of being a cultural throwback. "Should I change my clothes?" he would playfully ask his hippie entourage, and then would admire them for telling him, "Be yourself." Well-behaved rebellion marked his steady radicalization as the former supporter of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson spurred establishment politics. He once politely pleaded with a police officer, "I want to commit civil disobedience." The doctor aroused fierce but ill-focused attacks from both the right and the left. In 1968, he was tried and convicted on charges of conspiring to aid and abet draft resistors. His conviction was later reversed on appeal, and he was savaged by Norman Vincent Peale as the permissive cause of youthful rebellion. Peale accused him of promoting an ethos of instant gratification. "Feed them whenever they want, never let them cry, satisfy their every desire." Precisely the indulgent approach Dr. Spock himself had criticized. 4 years later, crisscrossing the country as the presidential candidate in a quixotic campaign run by the, quote, feminist, democratic, and socialist, end quote, People's Party, Dr. Spock found himself attacked by his own purported constituents, feminists. Some of them walked out when he addressed the National Women's Caucus, although he prefaced his remarks with an apology for, quote, some of the foolish things I've written and said about women. As soon as his speech ended, he recalls Gloria Steinem stood up and thundered in the tones of Jehovah, Dr. Spock, I hope you realize you have been a major oppressor of women in the same category as Sigmund Freud. The doctor was determined that his book keep up with the dizzying times, but updating the straight-laced second edition with its calls for more hierarchical family harmony posed a major challenge as the generation gap yawned. Women demanded liberation, and the family began to look far more fragile than anyone had expected. With the 1968 edition, Dr. Spock set a new direction for the three subsequent revisions as well. In 1976, and in 1985, and 1992, with a co-author, Dr. Michael B. Rothenberg. A seventh edition, due out in 1998, will be written with Dr. Stephen Parker, the Chief of Behavioral and Development Pediatrics at Boston City Hospital, and an Associate Professor at the Boston University Medical School. Dr. Spock now turned to that other drug of the inspirational how-to-er, religion, or the closest equivalent available to an agnostic doctor and a committed activist, which is to say, moral idealism. Fortunate are the parents with a strong religious faith, he announced in his 1968 revision. They are supported by a sense of conviction and serenity in all their activities. The next best guide in a disenchanted, disillusioned age, he proposed, was for parents to embrace a conviction that the most important and the most fulfilling thing that human beings can do is to serve humanity in some fashion and to live by their ideals. As the baby boomers begin to come of age, Dr. Spock gave them not just a child care manual, but fragments of a social manifesto. This was the kind of moralizing that his book had originally set out to avoid, and it marked the decline of faith in the power of psychology. We've lost a lot of our old-fashioned convictions about what kinds of morals and ambitions and characters we want our children to have, Dr. Spock, sounding rather like his mother chided in What Are Your Aims in Raising a Child?, a section he added to the 1968 edition. Instead, we have come to depend on psychological concepts. They've been helpful in solving many of the smaller problems, but they are of little use in answering the major questions. Dr. Spock's seemingly unprogressive swerve was prescient, an early form of increasingly public-minded rhetoric about family problems in America. It positioned him to accommodate feminism in his 1976 edition with a blurry blend of enlightened acceptance and nostalgic reservations, an ambivalence well-suited to a mass-market manual. He called for equal opportunity for women and scrubbed his book of sexism by downplaying boys' and girls' sex roles and emphasizing fathers' equal domestic roles. At the same time, he yearned for a more humane society, devoted to communal solicitude rather than to competitive career advancement, in which men and women can feel that the care of children and home is at least as important and soul-satisfying as any other activity. He paid surprisingly cursory attention to how working men and women and their children might actually feel and manage in the meantime. In picking a babysitter, he suggested you should avoid the person who is cross, reproving, fussy, humorless, or full of theories, just in case you were tempted. In the 1985 edition, though, he offered more clear-eyed counsel on other family permutations, in a new section called Divorce, Single Parents, and Step-Parents. He warned that mothers who gain custody of the children usually find the first year or two of divorce very difficult, and he minced no words about why. The children are more tense, demanding, and complaining. They are simply less attractive. But by the 1992 edition, Dr. Spock's concern about social disharmony and spiritual drift as the cause of rising family tensions had begun to sound familiar and more formulaic. A politics of virtue school was thriving, with Hillary Clinton, among others, proselytizing its mix of progressive social policies and old-fashioned moralism. Dr. Spock offered his version in uncharacteristic memo-like shorthand at either end of his book. In an opening section called Raising Children in a Troubled Society, he supplied readers with the address of the Children's Defense Fund, urging them to write for information on the programs most needed by children and families. In an afterword entitled A Better World for Our Children, he denounced the intense competitiveness and materialism of our society, emphasizing that human beings normally crave spiritual beliefs. He had slipped into the bland, inspirational style of countless conferences on the crisis of the American family. Dr. Spock's new public scope has meant a loss of intimacy. He has kept his eye, even as he added a co-author, but in the new sections, he has dropped the personal you of an individual reader. His prescription for making society cooperative and happier is sweeping. Parents should rear their children with strong values beyond their own needs. Cooperation, kindness, honesty, tolerance of diversity, and become politically active themselves. Dr. Spock once called it a fascinating and somewhat mysterious phenomenon, this one of the parents of America being this nervous about doing right by their children. Though he is always gratified to hear mothers and fathers say that he has been a great comfort to them, he himself is inclined these days to offer a bleak verdict on his 50-year effort to bolster parents' confidence and self-respect. "I don't see that what I've written has made any difference at all," he now says. As he watches baby boomer parents, the many Spock babies who have had their own babies later in life, he is disconcerted by how frazzled and contentious many families are. "I have a feeling that parents are still afraid to ask for respect," he goes on. "The mother or father has to argue for every point, and it uses up energy, and it uses up patience, and it uses up friendliness. It isn't good for the child, because it makes for a pesky child who's arguing all the time. Everywhere I go, at least half the children have got the upper hand." He catches himself. Maybe that's too strong, but he doesn't stop. "I think that children argue and resist and demand explanations, or they don't demand explanations. They state their positions. The parents who could and should stop the wrangling don't." But Dr. Spock, still ruthlessly self-critical, is too hard on his book and its legacy. As the child psychiatrist Dr. Stanley Greenspan observes, his influence is now taken for granted in the best sense of the word. It has become woven into the fabric of everyday life in such a way that people don't even know where it came from. And that is exactly what Dr. Spock has always wanted. He aspired to be an invisible advisor, one who could somehow persuade 20th century parents to stop looking for rules and solutions and see that in the end, as in the beginning, they had to muddle through on their own. Baby boomers have absorbed that message from America's household pragmatist, even if they still call on the experts when their children overwhelm them. Today, baby and child care is one manual among many in a field that is once again filled with dictatorial advocates of cut-and-dried technique. But the Spock generation isn't cowed by them, nor is it too credulous. The parents pick and choose and eclectically mix, and they always come back to Dr. Spock and the proponents of intuition whom he has inspired, among them T. Barry Brazelton and Penelope Leach. Parents don't sit on park benches these days worrying that some new child-rearing theory could make all their efforts look misguided and obsolete. They're hurrying frantically to get home in time for the old rituals and then wearily hoping that their children will go to bed on schedule so that they can too. Not Dr. Spock. As he and Mary Morgan left the restaurant, she announced that it was time to rest. "No, Mary, I don't want to take a nap," Dr. Spock whined with perfect pitch. And then grinning, he added, "None of my friends have to take naps." And now, from the May 6, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, what can we learn from broken things? The smashed, fractured, and non-functional can frustrate us and illuminate who we are. By Joshua Rothman. In my spare time, I am an obsessed photographer, and through the years, I've used dozens of cameras. A while ago, a horrible misfortune befell the one that I treasure most. Arriving home, I climbed out of the car without properly closing the top of my bag. As I stood, the camera, a beautiful and ludicrously expensive concatenation of electronics, glass, and brass, which I've used daily for years, flew out of its opening, falling to the asphalt behind me. I heard it land with a thud. The camera was damaged, of course, scratched and a little dented. But as I tested it, I discovered that it had broken in a surprising way. The screens and buttons on the back, with which one reviews pictures and adjusts certain settings, no longer functioned. But everything else, everything fundamental, was fine. The camera continued to take pictures and save them properly. Its dials still allowed me to control aperture, shutter speed, and exposure. It worked a lot like the film cameras I'd used off and on for many years. And I was startled to find, as I continued to use it, that I preferred it this way. With its more advanced digital features inoperative, it was less distracting, less complicated, more engaging, more fun. I decided not to send it in for repair and have enjoyed it in its damaged state ever since. The breaking of things is inevitable. The sooner one gets used to that, the better. But things break in different ways, and brokenness can have a variety of meanings. I genuinely like my broken camera. I even take a particular pride in using it. But I'm tortured by the busted handle on our patio door, which pops off when you pull on it, and which I've been trying and failing to fix for what seems like forever. My current suspicions center on a particular hard-to-find and perhaps proprietary screw. I'm similarly provoked by a halogen light in our kitchen, the center pendant of three, which keeps going dark even after its bulb has been replaced. ChatGPT informs me that the issue may be a transformer failure caused by the high temperatures of halogen bulbs. "It's a common problem," it says, "but one that an electrician will probably conclude is impractical to fix, and so we'll have to live with the useless pendant until all three can be replaced." These broken objects, and the others like them, feed into my general sense of being harried, overburdened, and middle-aged. And yet, our unused garden shed out back, which is covered in ivy and slowly tumbling down, conjures an almost wistful consciousness of the passage of time, as though it were a folly on a 19th century estate. And the broken toy airplane attached to the handlebars of my son's bike, it has a tiny red propeller that turns in the wind as he travels, is actually a source of anticipation, because I know that it will be easy to fix, and that fixing it will make him happy. Some people like to buy old, beaten-up furniture and refinish it. They see in those particular broken things opportunities for the expression of hope, patience, competence, imagination. Other kinds of brokenness can show us our fallibility, mortality, energy, adaptability, or capability. A broken thing is a cracked mirror in which you can assemble a range of reflections. There are philosophies of brokenness, which makes sense, given how much broken stuff disrupts the flow of our lives. How should we think about those disruptions? A practitioner of the Japanese ethic of wabi-sabi respects the beauty of brokenness. Instead of trying to erase the wear and tear that accrues inevitably with time, she finds a way of acknowledging and celebrating it. In a prototypical example of the philosophy, a teacup that has fallen and shattered is reassembled through the art of kintsugi, in which lacquer mixed with powdered gold or other metals is used to fill the cracks. Now the fractured, gilded cup tells a story of endurance, authenticity, acceptance, and care amid impermanence. Your favorite jacket, with a mended tear in its lining and the mark of an exploded pin below its pocket, has some wabi-sabi. So does your grandfather's watch, still functional, but with a scratch in its crystal. I like to imagine that the wabi-sabi salon in a town near mine helps its clients age gracefully. I've never visited. The German philosopher, Martin Heidegger, who wrote about how we experience ourselves and the world, argued that there were two ways we could relate to objects. A doorknob, he thought, could be ready to hand, something we reach for and use reflexively, unconsciously, without a moment's thought. But that same doorknob, if it breaks, can become present at hand. Precisely because it's not working, we notice it, examine it, try to figure it out so we can fix it. Broken things are often there for us in ways that working things aren't. What's true for doorknobs is also true for social norms, relationships, scientific theories, or institutions. When something works, you live in ignorance of it. When it breaks, you develop a belated expertise. In a sense, it's when things break that we discover them. Many years ago, at an academic conference, I listened to a talk in which a professor of literature observed that the protagonists in novels are often people for whom society is somehow broken. Most of the people in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, for example, just assume that the point of a young woman's life is to attract a man and get married. Only Lizzie, the heroine, finds herself unwilling to pass through the doorway of marriage. She refuses a proposal she finds unsuitable, and then starts to wonder what the point of marriage is anyway. Then her hesitation inspires a general reconsideration of everything, and she begins asking if any of her society's norms make sense. "The more I see of the world, the more I am dissatisfied with it," she tells her sister Jane. "Every day confirms my belief of the inconsistency of all human characters, and of the little dependence that can be placed on the appearance of merit or sense." In just this way, our attention can shift from a particular broken thing to the broader context behind its brokenness. If you find that your smartphone suddenly feels outdated, you might start reading about the idea of planned obsolescence or questioning your own consumerism. If you notice that a once inviting local park is now litter-strewn and dingy, you might change your vote for mayor. If something is broken, then maybe someone broke it. Who? But brokenness can also push our attention inward. Lizzie concludes that society is flawed, but she also has to change. She once saw herself as a good judge of people, but when she realizes how badly she's misunderstood the man she wants to marry, her judgment, which used to be ready to hand, is shown to be flawed and becomes there for her to inspect. "Till this moment, I never knew myself," she thinks. Is the acceptance of broken things a kind of self-acceptance? According to my wife's family lore, Uncle Bill, who grew up during the Depression, owned two television sets, one with no picture and one with no sound. He watched TV with them stacked one on top of the other. He also had a giant overstuffed recliner with a crank for the footrest. The crank no longer worked, and he kept the footrest propped up with a pile of books. When some younger family members bought him a new recliner, he was offended and refused it. strangely energizing to find out that you can live with a broken thing. It becomes a challenge you choose repeatedly to overcome. Or by living with it, you might be saying something about yourself and your own impermanent nature. These fragments I have shored against my ruins, T.S. Eliot wrote in The Wasteland. That sounds dark. Maybe it really is true that human beings are inherently broken, or at any rate headed that way, and are therefore surrounded by broken or breaking people and the flawed things they've created. In which case, the fractured stuff in our lives can remind us to take care, to practice compassion, to remain open-minded. At the end of The Wasteland, the poet finds spiritual solace in a broken world. It could even be that it's the world's brokenness that lets the light in. In any case, it's useful to know that broken things can teach us about our broken selves. If it's almost good when an inanimate object breaks, because it's then that we can start to examine it and fix it, then we might see our inner difficulties in a more positive light. It's when we recognize our thinking as broken that we can start to improve it. Maybe an attitude of wabi-sabi could be appropriate not just to our broken teacups, but to our plans, memories, and self-conceptions. Sometimes broken things are actually better that way. We benefit occasionally from accidents that seem unfortunate at first. Well, we've run out of time for today's issue of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.